This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Coming up, Princess Kate has cancer.
It has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay.
Her personal announcement after weeks of secrecy, speculation, and scandal about her health. Royal watchers in shock. Desperation, chaos, and an impending humanitarian catastrophe, the crisis in Haiti.
Some of my colleagues coming to the office, they reported that they can see dead bodies in the street.
So many are asking what, if anything, can be done about it. Plus, new deals on dining out.
We kind of felt like we had won the Applebee's lottery.
Customers celebrating cost-saving restaurant perks. All ahead on Perspective. A devastating diagnosis for Princess Kate, the Princess of Wales, suffering from an unspecified cancer discovered after major abdominal surgery in January. Follow-up tests revealing the cancer, forcing the princess to undergo preventative chemotherapy, which she says she's in the early stages of completing. Princess Kate telling the world in a recorded message.
This, of course, came as a huge shock. And William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I've said to them, I am well. And getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body, and spirit. Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance too, as is the love, support, and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both. We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I'm able. But for now, I must focus on making a full recovery.
Of course, this news comes after weeks of secrecy, speculation, and conspiracy theories surrounding her health, made worse by a doctored photo of the princess with her three children, released on Mother's Day in Britain and meant to show she's fine publicly. But wide-eyed royal watchers quickly noticed the picture had been edited, prompting major news outlets to pull the photo while the princess released a statement apologizing. ABC News Royals contributor Robert Jobson spoke to ABC's Kira Phillips, offering his reaction to Princess Kate's very personal statement.
Just the fact that she came forward, she made this video, she addressed everybody, the way she did it, the way that she looked, it was very simple, very humble. Do you think that was hard for her to do?
Oh, undoubtedly, it must have been very difficult for her when you're dealing with your own medical condition. But I think she did exactly the right thing after all the speculation online and all the nonsense that's been out there, the trolls, etc. I think she just wanted to show people this is coming from her. It is a statement from the heart. It's a statement about her medical condition. But also, I do think it's important that she appealed for privacy for her and her family because she's got three young kids and, you know, they are a... We mustn't lose sight. I know that they are royals and she's the Princess of Wales, but we mustn't lose sight of the humanity here, that she's got to deal with the children first. And that is something that really did come across in that statement.
ABC News Royals contributor Robert Jobson. The preventative chemotherapy that Princess Kate is undergoing is a major step in her treatment and recovery. ABC News medical correspondent Dr. Darian Sutton explained there are still some unknowns with ABC's David Muir.
It's really impossible to speculate what's happening here, at least from a medical perspective, because when you hear preventative chemotherapy, this really could be a category for a number of different types of cancer.
Absolutely, David. So when you talk about preventative chemotherapy, it really depends on what type of cancer we're talking about. It can be different from one patient to another. The main goals of preventative chemotherapy, commonly when they're used in the world of oncology, is number one, to prevent the risk of recurrence. And then in certain cases, the surgeon or the oncologist might be concerned that there are residual cancer cells there. And again, that goal of that preventative chemotherapy is to prevent those cancer cells from becoming a problem in the future.
So that's sort of two different categories. There could be a situation where the cancer they believe is out, but that they would prescribe preventative chemotherapy to make sure or to try to ensure it doesn't come back. There could be another scenario, for example, where they might believe there could be some cancer left and they want to try to go at it right away.
And that is quite possible. And also the type of chemotherapy is also indicated or dictated by the type of cancer we're talking about. In certain cases, you can have targeted chemotherapy, and in other cases, you can give more general chemotherapy. Now, that's important for the patient to know about just in terms of what to expect.
And when we hear about abdominal surgery back in January, this had been reported at the time. It would likely be foolish to assume that this is abdominal cancer. It could be any number of different types of cancer based on what they discovered afterwards, according to the Buckingham Palace here.
That's exactly correct. So when you talk about abdominal surgery and abdominal cancers, that can include a variety of different causes. We can talk about stomach cancer. We can talk about colon cancer. And we can also talk about uterine cancer, and ovarian cancer. All of these cancers, as well as other types of cancers, can be possible. But we do not know that information as we respect her privacy.
Dr. Darian Sutton with ABC's David Muir on the cancer diagnosis and chemotherapy treatment for Princess Kate. ABC's Maggie Rooley in London for the revelation and says Kate's cancer diagnosis leaves many in Britain blindsided, as if it's happening to someone close.
The royal family is so embedded in the culture here. Americans sort of look on from afar and are fascinated by it. But living in the UK, it's the family that people grow up with. It's people that are often thought of as almost the grandfather and grandmother, sister, brother in the room with them. And so having news like this, I mean, not only is it shocking, but it's heartbreaking for many people. Many people feel as if it's happening to almost a family member, someone they know really well, someone they've grown up with, and especially someone like Princess Kate. You know, she is so well-liked by the UK people. She's very well-loved. They have kind of grown up with her. She's been dating Prince William, now married to him for so long. They have three little kids that are cherished here. So to have this news come out, a cancer diagnosis about her, someone who's not only the Princess of Wales, but she's just 42 years old, it's shocking.
ABC's Maggie Rooley in London. Kate's cancer treatment follows a cancer diagnosis for King Charles. The king is 75 and revealed his cancer in February after undergoing treatment for an enlarged prostate. In a statement from Buckingham Palace, the king said he's so proud of Catherine for her courage in speaking as she did. Coming up, they were brutalized, tortured, one of them shot in a mock execution, two black men attacked by white police officers who called themselves the Goon Squad. The sentences they've all been given on perspective. After this,
we've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. Famine is imminent in many parts of Gaza as Israel's war with Hamas rages on. The United Nations now saying if conditions don't improve immediately, 70% of civilians will continue to experience catastrophic hunger. Israel recently doubling down on its plan to launch a ground offensive in Rafah, saying there are Hamas battalions that still need to be driven out. James Elder is a spokesman for UNICEF. He explained to ABC's Kira Phillips how aid trucks have been stalled at the Rafah border.
I know you talked to those bringing the trucks in. What were on those trucks and how many do you think were backed up there?
Well, Kira, hundreds. There's no doubt hundreds. I mean, everything that the people here so desperately need, food, but also water and medicines. These are the absolute essentials that are just so desperately lacking here. I mean, where I am here in Rafah, it's when you walk out, it's hard to walk around now, such as the density of people, people sleeping on the streets, people in tents. It's cold, it's been raining, and, you know, drones above them all the time. They know drones will drop bombs. There's trauma upon trauma for people here.
Tell us what you have seen with regard to these children and families not being able to get food. And now we're talking about starvation. We're talking about famine. I can't even believe that we had an interview with an Israeli official a couple of weeks ago saying, no, there's no starvation going on. Tell us what you're seeing.
I know it's something very that really pierces one's sort of soul, if you will. Not once, three, four, five times. Women, mums would, you know, hold my hand and just ask for anything, for some water. Particularly ask, please tell the world what's happening to us. They're afraid that their voices are not being heard. I think they are, but I don't think the right decisions are being made. There's a fear on the ground, Kira, because of disease and a lack of food, and there's always a constant threat from the skies.
You know, speaking of the skies, the U.S. has conducted these airdrops of aid, food into Gaza. Now there's the creation of this temporary port that's being built to bring in food supplies, whatever is needed, by water into the area. Is that making a difference at all?
Any aid, of course. But we have to be really clear, otherwise it is a dangerous distraction and then it's making a negative difference. The ship, great, but that was the equivalent to around 12 or 13 trucks. So it remains very clear that if we are going to avoid more children dying, because we now know that children are dying of malnutrition, they are dying of dehydration, horrendous ways for a child to die. The only way is to get that aid through on the roads, and it exists. The aid's a few miles from here, Kira. There are many, many other entrance points that the occupying power, with a legal responsibility to ensure the population has safety, certainly to ensure there is no famine, we are ready to deliver that aid if given the chance.
As you mentioned, you're there in Rafah. Israel is said to be preparing yet another launch and another offensive there, despite international outcry. There's more than 1 million Palestinians sheltering there in Rafah, trying to flee the fighting. Can they, though? And tell me what UNICEF is doing right now to just prepare for all this.
Rafah, as you rightly say, now has more than 1 million people. Rafah is a city of children. Rafah has twice the population density of New York City, but no high-rises. Everyone is literally on the ground. No, there is nowhere safe. We've seen that. I've never seen in my two decades with the United Nations, I've never seen the devastation. They can't go north. Two-thirds or more now, I guess, of homes have been destroyed. There's nothing to return to. So the idea that the people can be moved from A to B, they have moved. They have moved three or four, five times. They have taken the authorities' word to move and keep moving to a safe zone. Now they understand there is nowhere safe. An offensive in Rafah, in this city of children, where now more than half of Gaza's population is hiding, fleeing? No, that's apocalyptic. I think everyone is terrified, but realistic that this somehow might actually happen.
UNICEF spokesman James Elder with ABC's Kira Phillips. Torture, brutal assault, and humiliation. A so-called goon squad of six white police officers in Mississippi given sentences ranging from 10 to 40 years for their attack on two black men. The brutality happened last year, followed by a cover-up until the officers were caught, charged, and convicted for their crimes. ABC's Faith Abube has more on the case and the consequences levied against the officers in a conversation with Brad Milkey on our daily news podcast, Start Here.
Faith, we're talking about white cops and black suspects, right? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, this was a horrific, racially motivated crime perpetrated by law enforcement. And it's really hard to fathom that it happened just last year and not decades ago. And so what we've learned over the course of this case is that, you know, this all started back in January of last year. A white neighbor in Rankin County, Mississippi, called a deputy, an investigator with the sheriff's office, and wanted to report several black men for suspicious behavior at a nearby house. You know, there was even a mention that these black men were living in that house with a white woman, among other things. So this deputy decides it was worth looking into, and, you know, he reached out to his friends, a group of officers who call themselves the Goon Squad. We learned through court documents that they describe themselves that way because of their willingness to go beyond what's allowed, what's legally allowed. They use excessive force in the course of their jobs, and then they sweep it under the rug, essentially. So these white officers, four sheriff's deputies and a police officer, they show up at the house in question here. They break in without a warrant, and then they handcuff the two black men in that house, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, without any evidence of crime being committed. And that's where the story really gets grisly.
In their minds, the law and the Constitution be damned. They became the criminals they swore to protect us from.
These officers, they spend 90 minutes brutalizing and torturing these men in different ways, calling them racial slurs. The victims say they were sometimes waterboarded during the course of this. The deputies poured alcohol, syrup, milk on their faces while they laid there on the ground. They forced them to strip naked and shower together just to try to wipe off the evidence here. And then use stun guns repeatedly on them, a sex toy on them, and other objects, just assaulting them. Again, this went on for about an hour and a half. And then it gets worse. One of the officers, Elward, puts a gun in Michael Jenkins' mouth and pulls the trigger, shooting him execution style.
Wow.
He said that, you know, it was a mock execution that really went wrong. He didn't know that there was a bullet in that gun.
He's looking at me, I'm looking at him, and he sat there for a minute, and he pulled the trigger.
The bullet goes through Jenkins' tongue, goes through the back of his neck, and he's laying on the floor there. He's bleeding. These officers realize how bad the situation has gotten. And so instead of rendering aid, helping this guy, they huddle together to come up with a plan to cover up this crime. They take evidence from that house, some security footage. They plant a gun and some drugs to make it look like it was a drug bust. And then to add salt to injury, these victims were then criminally charged and had to spend months and months clearing their names before finally getting to this point where these officers are being sentenced for these crimes.
Well, and I'm wondering what this has meant to the community there in Mississippi, because this sounds like something you'd read out of, you know, a Mississippi Burning type novel or something. When we talk about law enforcement and the black populace of Mississippi, what is being said around the courtroom and around the state?
I mean, the details are hard to believe, but for this community, you know, there are obviously a lot of questions about, again, how deep does this rottenness go, right? Did it affect the entire police department or the entire sheriff's department? Who else knew?
I ain't feel nothing. I feel like you get exactly what you do.
And so after that sentencing, you know, we heard from the two victims here.
Are you happy with 20 years?
I'm satisfied.
One of them talked about how satisfied he is in terms of the sentences that came down. The other one also talked about how, you know, this is justice and that this was long overdue.
Ms. Parker said that you forgave Hunter Elward. Do you feel the same way?
No, I don't. I don't. Because if you wouldn't have got caught, you should be doing the same thing.
Jenkins, who was the one who was shot, says that, you know, he has not forgiven the officer here in this case. And so there's a lot of healing that they still have to go through. They're still living with a lot of trauma. And actually, there was a moment inside the courtroom as Elward was being sentenced where right before he had a chance to speak to the court, and he turned around and looked at the victims here and basically apologized for what he did. He said he hates himself for what he did.
It'll make my great-great-great-grandkids, it will let them have a different life. I hope they will never have to worry about this.
These victims are hoping that this case can sort of be an example of what can happen when, you know, claims of police brutality are taken seriously and critically examined. But again, this is only one chapter of the long road to justice for them. They're also filing a civil rights lawsuit for $400 million that these officers are going to have to face as well. So again, a lot here, and this is just the beginning, it seems.
ABC's Faith Abube with Start Here host Brad Milkey. One by one, each of the six officers has been sentenced, the longest punishment, 40 years in prison. Coming up, desperation in Haiti, death, starvation, and the collapse of basic services amid a surge in gang violence. On Perspective, after this.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Coming up, Washington, D.C.'s cherry blossom trees blooming early, endangering the already delicate flowers. But first, Haiti is a nation on the brink of total collapse, government services all but halted, gang violence taking over the streets of the capital city, Port-au-Prince, and there's widespread starvation impacting millions. The U.S. State Department airlifting Americans out of the country, which is incredibly risky, and Florida, with its huge Haitian population, is organizing charter flights. Philippe Armand and his family were on one of those flights. He says it took them 2 weeks to finally evacuate.
The days were turning into weeks, the weeks were turning into months, but we're very grateful to everyone that made this possible.
Haiti is on an island, and because the ports are now controlled by gangs, there's a real possibility the entire nation could run out of food in a matter of weeks. ABC's Matt Rivers is on the ground in Port-au-Prince and has more on the sheer desperation many are facing.
Haiti is in freefall. Its capital city, its beating heart, collapsing. For millions of Haitians in Port-au-Prince, gang violence and political chaos has turned their city into a twisted landscape. Many neighborhoods unrecognizably violent, many lives irrevocably changed. Police stations looted, hospitals abandoned, schools shut down, any sense of optimism fading. Flying above Port-au-Prince is the only relatively safe way to get into the city now. The airport is shut. The highway is gang-controlled, but it's only when you land that you see the decimation. In the city's downtown, charred remains of cars clog the streets. Apocalyptic in its tense quiet, the aftermath of a massive battle between the gangs and police. But that kind of carnage continues. Not far away, on the same day, the bodies of at least 13 people, all cut down within a quarter mile of each other, left to die on the streets. Haitian gangs have spent the last several weeks terrorizing this city. An unholy alliance of the most powerful armed groups turning their guns on the government, forcing acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry to resign. His replacement set to be a transitional presidential council, yet to be named, but already denounced by the gangs. This violence will continue. And it is the police officers still donning the uniform in Haiti each day that are the only thing standing in the way of total gang control. We spoke to one of those officers on the front lines, a member of an elite unit whose job is to battle the gangs.
The real problem is we don't have enough equipment. We don't have enough equipment to counterattack. And very often, they are better armed than us.
Simply existing is what so many are forced to do here these days, lurching forward minute by minute, just surviving.
So amidst all this violence, thousands and thousands of people have been forced to flee with basically just the clothes on their backs. But there's no shelter system in Port-au-Prince. They're forced to just go anywhere they can, and ultimately leads to these makeshift shelters, which technically is the Ministry of Communication here, but now it's filled with all kinds of people.
It's where you go when society is breaking down. This wasn't the plan, but when the government fled the building, people moved in. They're all among the thousands forced to flee their homes as gangs and police fight in the streets. Like Marie Lina and her 11-year-old, Fabian.
Since we came, we found no help. Nobody helps us. We are dying of hunger. The babies are dying of hunger. The disabled are dying of hunger. The blind are dying of hunger. The young are dying of hunger. Everyone is dying of hunger.
But for now, though, there is no one coming to save the day. Aid groups are trying their best, but the help, it's more of a trickle when you need a torrent. Ports are closed, politicians are deadlocked, and any foreign intervention, a fraught idea to say the least. And yet, all the while, Fabian, the 11-year-old kid, has to sleep on the floor, surrounded by strangers, completely unsure when his next meal will be.
ABC's Matt Rivers. Young fans and their parents know the Nickelodeon shows Drake and Josh, as well as All That and others. They were some of the most popular kid shows on TV, but some of the child actors who brought those shows to life are accusing Nickelodeon and some of the staffers involved of fostering a toxic workplace. One star opening up about being sexually abused. ABC's Eva Pilgrim has more on the revelations in a new documentary, Quiet On Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV.
If we don't get all these people out of here in less than 2 hours, our lives are over.
Drake Bell from the show Drake and Josh revealing for the first time publicly that he is the John Doe victim in the 2003 child sexual abuse case against his dialogue coach, Brian Peck. Bell claims that Peck purposely isolated him from his father, who was also his manager.
I think Brian got a sense that my dad was on the watch. And so he started to really drive a wedge between my dad and me. He started talking about how my dad's stealing my money. Nobody likes that my dad's on set. He's a real problem. I was believing it because he's been in this business for so long and he must know more than us.
Peck was convicted in 2004, sentenced to 16 months in prison, and is now a registered sex offender. Bell says that abuse put him on a path of self-destruction, including two DUIs and a 2021 child endangerment conviction. Nickelodeon saying in a statement, "We are dismayed and saddened to learn of the trauma he has endured, and we commend and support the strength required to come forward." Giovanni Samuels and Brian Hearn starred in All That in 2001 and say Peck worked closely with the child actors.
When you saw who the victim was,
it broke my heart. I cried.
To find out that he was being harmed.
Brutally harmed.
In a terrible way, it infuriated me.
Hearn and Samuels also speaking about former writer and executive producer Dan Schneider, who Nickelodeon parted ways with in 2018 after complaints he created a hostile work environment.
What was it like working for Dan Schneider?
Dan.
You're asking the two black children on a Nickelodeon set where
we were overlooked.
Hearn and Samuel say they hope the series sparks an important conversation about the treatment of child actors.
Your childhood is going to be a little tainted after watching it, but I hope that it helps you protect the next group of kids that comes up.
Now, about the hostile workplace allegations, Nickelodeon tells ABC News, while it cannot corroborate or negate allegations of behavior from productions decades ago, it investigates complaints as part of our commitment to fostering a safe and professional workplace environment free of harassment or other kinds of inappropriate conduct. We have adopted numerous safeguards over the years to help ensure we are living up to our own high standards and the expectations of our audience. As for Schneider, a spokesperson tells ABC News, his scripts went through multiple layers of executive approval, and that Dan expected a lot from his teams, but he also knows some people did not have a positive experience, and he is truly sorry for that.
ABC's Eva Pilgrim. Schneider has apologized on his YouTube channel. He said watching his past behavior outlined in the documentary was embarrassing and that he regrets making anyone feel uncomfortable. Coming up, looking for a deal on dining out? There are plenty to go around. Restaurant chains offering subscriptions to save. On Perspective, after this. You're listening to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. It's a sure sign of spring, the blooming of the pink and white cherry blossom trees around the Tidal Basin in Washington, D.C. The trees are beloved, a major tourist attraction, and a point of pride for Washington. But this year, because of an unusually mild winter, the trees have bloomed early, ahead of the annual Cherry Blossom Festival in D.C., which would typically come before peak bloom. Scientists say warming temperatures are causing cherry blossoms all over the world to bloom earlier, and Washington is no exception. And there's another threat. Rising sea levels into the Tidal Basin are leaving the National Park Service no choice but to cut down more than 150 cherry blossom trees that have lined the waterfront for more than a century. One of the trees being removed, the ailing tree nicknamed Stumpy, which has become infamous for its distressed appearance. Hannah Hancock with the Trust for the National Mall says it all means the trees are so delicate.
We've had the tree since 1912 as a gift from Japan, and so there are trees getting up there in age. There's a lot of work year-round that goes into preserving these trees, some pruning, some cutting, snipping of the branches, and really just ensuring that they have enough mulch, that they're fed, that they're watered.
Peak bloom for the cherry blossoms has shifted earlier by about 7 days since 1921. The average peak bloom for the trees is April 4th, but this March has been one of the warmest on record for Washington, D.C. so far. Multiple sclerosis is a disease of the central nervous system that attacks a person's brain, spinal cord, and optic nerves, controlling everything we do. Everyday people and celebrities alike are battling it, including famous actress Christina Applegate. It's changed her appearance and her speech, but not her sense of humor. And she's found a support system in her best friend, a fellow actress who is also suffering from MS. ABC's Robin Roberts sat down with them both.
I live kind of in hell. I mean, I'll be honest, you know, my daily life is kind of and I'm alone. And sorry, I keep cussing. It's very hard. I'm a cusser these days.
Okay.
Big time.
You're loud.
And Christina!
Little allowances, giving herself grace, all a part of Christina Applegate's new reality, living with multiple sclerosis. For the actress, beloved since her role on Married with Children.
Do you think that for 1 second I'm going to stay here and study when I'm just a paternity suit away from Jamaica?
She has been quietly coping out of the spotlight.
Right now I'm isolating, and that's kind of how I'm dealing with it, is by, like, not going anywhere because I don't want to do it. It's hard.
This year, she's stepping out again ahead of a new podcast after having Hollywood on their feet for her at this year's Emmys.
You can't have one without the...
Were you able to take in the moment, the standing ovation and everything?
I actually kind of blacked out. People said, oh, you were so funny. And I'm like, I don't even know what I said.
You're totally shaming me with disability by standing up. It's fine. Okay.
And now, sitting beside Applegate as we spoke and holding her hand the entire time, Jamie Lynn Sigler, best known for her role as Meadow in The Sopranos.
Dad, how come you didn't finish college?
I had that semester and a half at Seton Hall.
And I was so happy for her moment at the Emmys because I'm like, please just remember how great you are. But also respect what she's going through because she's also just been through a lot.
what they're both going through, MS, a degenerative autoimmune disease. Now they're teaming up and sharing their story each week like never before.
You're really eavesdropping on an intimate conversation. You're also listening to a podcast of like two women that are really being there for each other and getting to know each other.
For more than 40 years, Christina Applegate has starred in some of America's favorite film and TV shows, from Married with Children to Anchorman.
I said, your hair looks stupid.
When you were diagnosed, you were in the middle of your show.
My symptoms had started in the early part of 2021, and it was like literally just tingling on my toes. And by the time we started shooting in the summer of that same year, I was being brought to set in a wheelchair, and then I needed someone to help. Sorry. I needed someone to help me to get there. Sorry.
Jamie received her diagnosis at age 20 in the midst of filming The Sopranos. But for more than 15 years, she kept her MS a secret.
My focus was, when I worked, was getting through the day and not being found out. I didn't feel important enough or valued enough that anybody would still want me. But now I'm at this place where, like, the next thing I do, I don't want to hide this. Like, why can't I just be
It was torture. You were tortured by doing that.
Yeah. Makes you feel like something's wrong. And there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not broken.
MS is a disease with no cure, but a strong community, bringing the two women together. And now, gearing up for the launch of their new podcast, Messy, about their public journeys with MS.
We're messy, life is messy, and so, you know, there was no other name for this podcast. But
and
that.
Also, and it has, M and S are in it.
But even with someone to lean on, MS can be especially challenging. Symptoms can include trouble with coordination, speech difficulty, vision loss, and even paralysis.
You have to hide the selfie.
I gained 40 pounds when I got sick, 40. Like little tiny Christina Applegate was like all of a sudden just like Jabba.
As heartbreaking as it is to struggle physically, it's given me a perspective and an appreciation that I just know I wouldn't possess without it. My hopes for her and for us through this journey, especially with this podcast, is that people can witness two people trying to figure that out.
You know, I've been playing a character called Christina for 40 years. This is like, it's kind of my coming out party.
Yeah.
Like this is the person I've been this whole time.
After we recorded our first episode and we listened to it, the first thing I did was call her. And I was like, I am so excited for people to get to know this Christina.
Well, Christina Applegate, it's nice to finally meet you.
Again. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice to finally meet you.
Yeah.
Christina Applegate with her best friend, Jamie Lynn Sigler, sitting down with ABC's Robin Roberts. Before we go, with just about everyone feeling the pinch of inflation and looking to save a buck these days, several restaurant chains are offering incredible dining deals to get customers in the door at a discount. Yeah, we fancy like Applebee's. Applebee's has launched a new dining subscription called the Applebee's Date Night Pass. It's a $200 pass valued at $1,500 that gives users $30 worth of food and drinks once a week for a year. The pass selling out in less than a minute. But customer Emily Brooks was able to snag one and says it's a good deal.
We haven't been going out to eat as much since the cost of going out to eat has really increased. And so it's been helping us to stay within our dining out budget.
Other restaurants are also promoting subscriptions to get customers to come in. Red Robin offering more than 30 all-you-can-eat or drink items, including unlimited refills on sides and drinks. Red Lobster has a buy one, take one promotion. Customers buy one entree and get a second one to take home for just $6. Panera has an unlimited sip club for $14.99 a month with unlimited refills on certain drinks. And if you bring your busted March Madness brackets to a TGI Fridays, you get 6 boneless wings for free. But why are restaurant chains doing this? Retail analyst Hitha Herzog says it's a win-win.
It helps the consumer in a couple ways. One, consumers are able to get the food that they like at discount prices. And number two, it builds a brand loyalty for the customer and the restaurant.
Of course, all these promotions come as the cost of dining out has gone up 29% higher than 5 years ago, according to the U.S. Labor Department. But while you count the savings with all these restaurant subscriptions, be sure to count the calories, too. Dining out at these chains on a subscription plan might help your bottom line, but not necessarily your waistline. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. This show is produced by Aaron Ferrer, Marwa Muwaki, and Joy Piazza. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review. If you've got the time, tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Derek Dennis.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.